Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Darren Zanovich, President and CEO of Mesa Minerals Partners, who came back onto the podcast to break down the final exit of their Haynesville assets in Mesa 2 to Franco Nevada, as well as an update on the status of their portfolio in Mesa 3, including their position in the Permian, and how they've rebuilt their Haynesville portfolio to over 12,000 NRAs via their latest acquisition from Noble Royalties. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Darren had to say.
All right, Darren, welcome back onto the podcast. I was joking around with you a couple minutes ago. I think you're officially number one in terms of appearances now on the podcast, but it's for good reason. Every time you come on, there's a bunch of press releases that we're recording this on the tail of, and it's fun to see you guys continue to do your thing. So welcome back. It's good to have you.
Thanks, Tim. Good morning. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, for sure. So last time you came on, quick recap, it was September 2023. You had a couple of things to talk about at that time, the Haynesville exit to Saxum in Q4 2022. You had press released an exit to Whitehawk in the Haynesville as well in Q1 2023. And you also launched a Permian mineral strategy. So, you know, I think it would be good for you to just do a quick refresher up to that point, and then we'll kind of take it from September onwards, what you guys have been up to, and then we'll dive into the meat of the episode.
Yeah, that's right. So definitely we had some exits along the way here, both to the Whitehawk Group and Saxum. And those two different exits plus our cash flow really got us to where we're at on our return on that. And that was all done, you know, in 22 and 23, and then kind of leading us up to where we're at now.
Yeah, I mean, it is impressive. I mean, years ago, right, kind of leading up to COVID, everyone was saying, is private equity the wrong cost of capital for minerals? It doesn't work. You can't do it. You know, kudos to you and your team. You know, I think you're one of the only ones who have been able to successfully make the PE back model work in minerals. I mean, you've built and sold three companies now, right? Including Haymaker. So the returns have been your benchmark returns, you know, 2x plus MOIC. Given how well you've done, your team's done on the execution of quick turnarounds on these build and flips, has driven IRRs really high. And so, yeah, congratulations on that. And the recent Haynesville acquisition means it looks like you're getting ready to do it again for a fourth time, right? So anyways, let's, I really think the fun part of this conversation is going to be Haynesville and gas markets and LNG. And that's where your last two deals were announced, but you built a pretty robust Permian portfolio. So when you came on September, you talked about in Mesa 3, the launch of buying in the Permian. Where's that at today? What does it look like? Over to you, talk about size, counties, core thesis, et cetera, et cetera.
We have spent a lot of time in the Permian over the last 12 months. You know, our portfolio today looks like this, around 4,300 net royalty acres. The counties that we're focused in, you know, 1,100 acres NRA in Loving County, a little over 1,100 NRA in Ward County. On the Delaware side, around 1,500 NRA in kind of what we call the core Midland Basin, kind of smaller interest over a larger area in the Midland Basin. NTM cash flow from our Permian assets right now, about 9 to 10 million. 12 rigs on our acreage today, 102 gross WIPs, 91 gross permits, so lots of activity, lots of rigs on the acreage. Big focus for us is you know, continuing to utilize our large ground game machine. You know, we have over 50 buyers now as part of our ground game, and probably 80% of those guys are focused in the Permian for us right now today. So probably one of the larger, call it ground game teams as far as scale, buying in the Permian. Still a big focus for us on buying rock in the right areas. Like we're, you know, obviously we see Loving County as kind of the Midland County of the Delaware Basin, the best, absolute best rock in the play. So we've probably had more of a focus on being in the right zip code than just buying a lot of acreage. We've seen a lot of packages recently that have been on the market that, you know, maybe there's 30% of the acreage is high quality and, you know, 70% of it is not. It's more like second pass zone inventory, what we call it. And it's just, it's harder. And so what we're trying to build is something that's more all core when we bring that to market in the next few years.
Welcome to An Ounce of Prevention. The team at Our Recent Associates has partnered with Tim Powell to bring you brief legal updates on issues that matter to mineral owners, non-ops, and operators. We hope you find this segment informative. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me, Rachel Reese, at podcasts@rreeselaw.com. Today's case is a recent ruling by the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals, but coming out of the state of Pennsylvania, called American Home Assurance Company versus Superior Well Services, Inc., that focuses on accidents, insurance, and breaches of warranty. In this case, Superior was a vendor contracted by U.S. Energy Development Corporation to frack some wells owned by U.S. Energy. American is Superior's insurer and provided Superior with commercial general liability insurance covering property damage arising out of an occurrence. In October 2007, Superior was informed by U.S. Energy that Superior had damaged several wells during fracking. U.S. Energy claimed, and the jury ultimately found, that Superior breached their warranty to perform services in a good and workmanlike manner, and the jury awarded U.S. Energy approximately $13 million. Prior to the judgment, however, Superior declared bankruptcy. Superior and U.S. Energy turned to the insurer, American, who refused to pay the judgment, arguing Superior's failure to frack the wells in a workmanlike manner brought Superior's actions outside the coverage of their insurance policy, which is what we're talking about today. The Third Circuit agreed with American, holding that the occurrence-based insurance policy American provided to Superior does not include coverage for work done in an unworkmanlike manner. American's insurance policy defined occurrence as an accident, but didn't define accident itself. Under Pennsylvania precedent, the plain meaning of accident requires an unexpected and undesirable event. And faulty workmanship cannot be an accident because it is too foreseeable to be considered an accident. So why should you care? Well, assume with me for a second that U.S. Energy had a knock-for-knock indemnity in its contract with Superior, whereby U.S. Energy was responsible for damage to its well, even if Superior was negligent. The only way for U.S. Energy to recover in this instance against Superior would be to base its claim on a breach of warranty. But what this case is saying is that there is no insurance under a standard occurrence-based CGL policy for claims of breach of warranty. So vendors and operators, if the vendor goes bankrupt like Superior did, might be left holding the bag. Thanks for listening, and I hope you found this informative. I'd like to thank Siam Rahman, a law clerk in our Houston office, for this content. As always, subscribe to our blog, An Ounce of Prevention, or follow us on LinkedIn for the latest updates.
The information and material in this advertisement is general information about our practice and firm and is for educational and informational purposes only. This information does not offer specific legal advice, and the use of this information does not create an attorney-client relationship with RRNA or any of its attorneys. The information in this advertisement should not be considered legal advice, and persons should not act upon this information without first engaging professional legal counsel.
What's interesting here, you know, the 1,500 NRAs spread across the core of the Midland Basin. You know, when I talk to Permian shops in general, putting capital to work in the Midland Basin is just very difficult right now. It's very competitive. It's super fragmented. And it's just getting very, very pricey. Talk to me about the dynamics of just how you've executed on those deals. Has it been a ton of tiny boots on the ground type deals? Did you just hang around the hoop with some folks and just some stuff shook loose? I mean, how did you get that? Because a lot of folks have found success in the Delaware. There's some blockier positions. You know, we've talked about it before, both at the conference and on the podcast, the importance of having geology acumen on the team to be able to look at faults and understand the Delaware. But Midland's more delineated, a lot more offset data. Just as a result, a little more competition, right? And a lot of folks have been buying there forever. So we'll talk about the Delaware in a second, but the Midland Basin, break it down.
Yeah, so for us, our Midland position, you know, majority of that came from an acquisition we made from the Anthem guys in Midland, guys we've known for a long time. I think that was probably 1,000 or 1,100 of that acreage. So, you know, the majority of that came from that one acquisition we made. And then, you know, really, like to your point, the Midland has become, I'd say, so difficult to buy in that we really focus most of our efforts on the Delaware side at this point. And we're more like, I'd say, reactionary to Midland deal flow, whereas we're proactively going out and trying to acquire Delaware acreage with our buying team, you know, in our ground game. You know, Midland is more something, if something comes in the door and we can get an ask price, we're going to work it. But what we're seeing in the Midland Basin is, you know, newer groups that have come in are groups that just see the world vastly different than we do when it comes to type curves. I think it's the biggest thing over there. And they're looking at areas in, you know, Glasscock and Reagan County in the same lens we look at stuff in, you know, core Midland and Martin. And it's just, that's just not the way to see the world. So I think we've kind of officially reached the tapping point in the Midland Basin. On the Delaware side of things, you know, very different. You know, it is more geologically complex. We have two geologists on staff now that work with us. And, you know, it's really important in the Delaware, given the faulting, given the debris flow, given all the different subsurface risks that are out there, that you have a geologist that's looking at that. You know, we spend a lot of time looking at landing zones in the Delaware. You know, Enverus doesn't always get those right. I mean, you're really trying to understand, you know, and operators come in and have drilled, you know, three or four wells in a unit to certain zones. What you have to kind of put your operator hat on, both from a geology and from a reservoir engineering standpoint, to say, hey, what are the zones they're going to come in and fill in here? Or is this something they're going to come in and co-develop? Or is it going to be an infill situation? And really trying to wrap your hands around that, which I'm not sure that we see a lot of, like, every group that's out there that's competing with us have that same level of diligence on that front. But we believe that's really important. And that's kind of what differentiates us in the Delaware from other groups.
How have you seen mega EMP merger activity and just the consolidation of the upstream space affect the mineral buying opportunity set in the Permian? Has that dust settled yet? Or do you see it potentially as an opportunity where the waters have been muddied and, you know, given the different buckets of capital you have with NGP, you can pull different levers and kind of go in and just get deals done? Because I think the biggest thing with the Permian is just how competitive it is. So if there's a little bit extra uncertainty on, okay, where does this acreage sit in NewCo merger that's $30 billion in size? Well, hell, it's going to get drilled at some point. That little pause in the market maybe is an opportunity for you to jump through that window and just get the deal done, right? But just curious, it's a question I ask a lot now, and I don't think I've heard any great answers because people are still trying to figure it out. But it's an interesting time. I think it's very analogous to the late 90s. When the majors and super majors were formed, I mean, we're really looking at large scale consolidation and a lot of rigs being removed from the Permian, right? Just for efficiency and economies of scale. So how do you guys view the world from that perspective?
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, most of those mega mergers have happened on the Midland side. And again, we're more reactionary on Midland than proactively going out there. So hasn't affected us as much on the Midland side. You know, to the extent the larger acquisitions that have happened on the E&P side in the Delaware, I think that's a positive. You know, most of those groups that have bought in there are looking for Delaware inventory. And so whether they bought it from private equity, we love the private equity guys because they didn't have a lot of inventory. The guys buying in are paying a lot of money for that inventory. We believe we're going to come in there and drill it quickly. So haven't seen a huge impact from us on the Delaware side where we spend most of our time.
Okay, very good. Let's shift gears now to your Haynesville portfolio. And, you know, it's funny, I would say a year or so ago, as I'm talking to you, I'm saying, okay, gas prices are kind of high, market's gotten very competitive, Dyer's now entering the Permian. It seems like there's a shift in focus back on the Permian and Haynesville. It's going to be a monetization kind of blowdown type scenario. And here you are now ramping back up. You know, you sold down the remaining assets of Mesa 2 to Franco-Nevada. And then you've recently bought a sizable Haynesville portfolio from Noble Royalties. So gas is very low. When commodities are this low, it's a great opportunity to buy. You bought and sold in a very similar window. So I'm curious to kind of unpack that. But let's start with really where y'all's headspace was strategically as a team. It's summer of 2023. Gas prices now have been lower, right? Call it $2 to $3 for better part of 9 months, maybe. Where are you strategically as a team as you look at buying in the Haynesville or selling in the Haynesville, just outlook on gas as you get another large commitment from NGP and you're looking to continue to make money for your investors? Over to you.
Yeah, so we got the new commitment from NGP. And again, it was a dual focus in the Permian and Haynesville. We were back on the ground in the Haynesville kind of doing our thing. You know, I think to date, we put together about 4,000 acres on the ground. We've had our eye on this acquisition opportunity that you mentioned in the Haynesville for quite a while. Very unique in that we've struggled over the years to buy under Aethon in the Haynesville. This portfolio was primarily under Aethon and had some really good acreage both in the core Louisiana and the Shelby Trough. And so for us, this is a very strategic acquisition, something we've had our eye on, that we've been talking to these guys for quite a while. It was an off-market deal. You know, it probably took around 4 to 5 months between the first time we said, hello, let's try to do something here, till we got the thing closed. But very strategic in that, you know, for us, is going to put our portfolio about 50% Southwestern Chesapeake, 50% Aethon, which is right where we want to be. We weren't able to buy Aethon as much on the ground as this group and possibly other groups have been able to. So strategic from that standpoint, you know, Aethon is an operator that we like a lot. And I know how familiar you are, the listeners are with Aethon, but, you know, they've been the most active operator in the Haynesville over the last several years. They have the biggest fracs. They have the tightest spacing where they come in and drill six wells a section. They have their own midstream, so they're integrated in that way, which insulates them from, you know, potential lower price environments that we're seeing right now. And really overall, they have the best EURs and the best results in the play. So someone we've always wanted to get more of and weren't able to. And the strategic acquisition allowed us to do that. And now, you know, thinking kind of going forward, this is going to allow us to really build out this portfolio to look something like we had at Mesa 2 before, where, you know, I don't know, in 2 to 3 years, are we back at 16 to 20,000 net royalty acres with a huge cash flow profile and, you know, something that looks more like 50% PDP and 50% inventory. That was kind of the strategic rationale and definitely something we've had our eye on for a while.
Yeah, no, you've mentioned in the past about just the size of the Haynesville is much smaller than the Permian. And it's very, very difficult to organically put together flagship positions. A lot of it's been done already. And so if your team has kind of coveted a strong Aethon position, you went after who's done it already. And just timing wise, it made sense for both counterparties to transact. So that's phenomenal. You've also talked in the past about the importance of having a base asset to then build around on the ground game. You guys have been in the basin now for 6 years. So I think your name on the ground speaks for itself as a ground game buyer, but does it come up in conversation of just, hey, we're back or we're still here, or, you know, in terms of, you know, reputation and wanting to be the main aggregator, where does this latest acquisition fit in?
Yeah, I think it definitely, we feel like we get last shot at most deals that are in the Haynesville and are kind of the buyer of choice. Been there, like you said, for 6 years. This was, you know, that flagship asset that we've been kind of looking forward to get this kind of scale. Again, I didn't think we'd be able to replicate, you know, the size and scale that we did in Mesa 2 again, but this asset and this acquisition that we acquired is going to allow us to do that. Again, we're around 12,000 acres now today, and we believe we're going to be able to easily put together another 3,000 to 5,000 acres over the next few years to get back to that size that we had at Mesa 2. And so we never really left the basin. I mean, when we sold Mesa 2, we had already overlapped and started Mesa 3 and had started our ground game again. So we really, like to your point, we never really left the basin. We've always kind of been there, always kind of view ourselves as the buyer of choice, whether it's on the ground or whether it's an end buyer in the basin.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Looking to ramp up deal flow for your minerals and non-op ground game? Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has closed on over 120 deals, totaling $110 million in value, with deal sizes ranging from $50,000 upwards of $5 million. Whether you're looking for white space, permit, duck, PDP, AFE, or wellbore-only deals, the Texas Mineral Company has got you covered. For more information on how to source deal flow from the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagle Ford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests, or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Does your team ever struggle with employee turnover? What about right-sizing your team to fit your company's needs over time? Do you have the right accounting systems and software in place to maintain control and visibility on all your cost centers? If any of these things are challenges in your business, then Opportune's back office outsourcing could be the right solution. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com.
So you mentioned kind of the tactical strategic reasons to buy that asset. You know, it was 6,200 NRAs, which is what was press released. But Mesa 3 now owns 12,000. None of that is carrying over from Mesa 2. Mesa 2 has been completely liquidated. So that's quite impressive. You've done 5,000 to 6,000 just through ground game and small rollups.
That's right.
Okay, awesome. So break down the 6,200 NRAs then a little more granularly. So ResCat mix and NTM and all that, if you don't mind, just so we can get an idea of outside of the Aethon exposure, you know, what it looks like today and what likely it'll look like in a couple of years, right?
Perfect. It's also got exposure to Southwestern and Chesapeake, you know, again, primarily Aethon, 75-80% Aethon, 0.3 net wells of DUCs and permits, 1.1 net wells from what's called pre-app permits on the Louisiana side, and then 2 net inventory wells. So really think of it as about 3.1 net inventory locations that we've got and 2 net wells of PDP. In addition to that, you know, that the assets making around 8 million NTM cash flow. And something we look at that we really liked about this asset is the coverage ratio. And I've heard other people talk about this on your show as well, but the coverage ratio on this we look at is a 1.3 times, and that's from PDP, DUC permits, and pre-apps. You're getting 1.3 times your money back on kind of like what you can see on the asset today. And so we look at that when we make these big acquisitions. That's kind of one of the criteria. And then also looking at kind of the payout period. And, you know, right now, you know, at strip pricing, this asset, you know, at how we have it forecasted, it's going to pay out in less than 5 years. So all of those kind of criteria are important to us. Probably more importantly on this was the scale that it brings us, as well as the operator mix with Aethon, which is something, like, again, that we've struggled with. But, you know, the yield on this is perfect for our royalty fund. It's, you know, call it 13-14% yield for 2024 off that asset alone, growing to over 20% yield in 2025. So it's the royalty fund, you know, to a T with existing cash flow yield on it day one, where we could start distributing to our investors, but also has a lot of running room, also allows us to get the scale with what we bought plus what we're going to buy to put together another really sizable, meaningful Haynesville portfolio that we could bring to market. And, you know, maybe it won't be in 2 to 3 years like we did Mesa 1 and Mesa 2, you know, but both of those were always designed to be more like 3 to 5 year holds before we sold. You really want to get your cash flow back and, you know, by year 3 to 5. And then at that point, and looking at the exit, we were able to do that quicker in Mesa 1 and 2. We're, given the structure we have with NGP and the royalty fund, we're perfectly happy with holding this for 3 to 5 years. It could hold it for as much as 7 to 10 years and distribute cash flow if we need to. But that's kind of the beauty of royalties in general, but probably more so with the structure of the capital that we have.
I want to circle back on the coverage ratio. That isn't something I hear very regularly. It makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, I don't know if that's going to be kind of a new metric that's tracked by a lot of teams, but basically you engineer out, you know, the timing on the near-term development, and you want it to at least cover your basis. Is that the premises? And then the PUD analysis is all upside and gravy. I mean, just break down that little methodology. I think it would be interesting for folks listening.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly right. We put our own money into all of these deals too, just like everybody else does, you know, when they're a portfolio company on the private equity side. And you know, one of the things that's obviously important to us is, like, you know, downside scenarios where you could say, you know, the world ends, what does this look like? And I think when you could look at something and say, look, this is what's on the asset today, and get really comfortable that's over a one, that can get you really comfortable buying these large portfolios. Not to say that everything's going to work out and be rosy. It's just one of the things that we look at, along with a payout, along with yield, you know, along with cash flow, you know, all those things are what we look at. But, and probably more importantly, we look at pro forma. What is that with our existing assets? What does that look like? And that can definitely differ. You know, if we didn't have an asset, you know, would we have wanted to do this? Not sure. But, you know, we've always been of the belief that we have to buy an anchor asset and then do what we're good at on the ground game to kind of build around that and buy the right res cats that we need after we kind of have a base asset.
So what I find interesting, you know, headline reading, not gas or inflation adjusted, near an all-time low, if not all-time low, right? When there's blood in the streets, buy, 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 you're buying at value. There's a great thesis, which we'll circle back at the end of the episode on your views on LNG markets and nat gas pricing and just what the next 2 to 4 years looks like. So we'll revisit that. But in general, there's a thesis that looks very strong to where pricing goes up, right? And so you're going to get nice uplift on pricing and development activity because of that. So buying makes a ton of sense. Now, on the flip side, you guys just sold a pretty big portfolio. Walk me through that. And I think the exercise I want to walk through here with you is really what I love about minerals is how dynamic you can be and how there's different ways and strategies to return money to investors at great returns. And so at a hype, you know, at a theoretical level, why would you ever sell right now at these prices? But there's other factors at play. It could be the stage of the fund you're at, pref rates, how deep you are into your waterfall, if you haven't hit it yet. I mean, there's so many things at play. And I think just for those listening, we all know each other so well. We go to Mark and dinners and receptions and all this. And we're constantly talking to each other because you have to be on top of this stuff because it's not just as linear as my PUDs converted to permits, DUCs, and PDP, gas prices are higher or commodity prices are higher, and now it's the optimal time to sell. There's so many other factors at play. So we'd love to just kind of theoretically, you guys are really, I think, the masters at portfolio management in private equity. You've done it 3 times. I'm willing to put my money, you know, in Vegas on you doing it a 4th time. There's a lot of just striking at the right time and moving assets in and out, cost averaging in and out, all that. So you guys, you know, ink a term sheet with Franco-Nevada, $125 million. Was that CAD or US, by the way?
That was US dollars.
Okay, so US $125 million exit of the remaining Haynesville assets in the Mesa 2 vehicle, inked in December 2023 to Franco-Nevada. Gas prices are still low then. Why sell? Why not hold it for 3-4 more years like the thesis is for Mesa 3? Over to you.
So we started talking to the Franco-Nevada guys probably in the summer of 2023. And at that point, you know, I think gas was 325-ish, 330, somewhere in that range on the front end. Back end was really healthy. By the time, you know, we actually, you know, inked a PSA with them, it was more like November. Gas was still pretty healthy at that point. I mean, gas didn't take the fall until later on. And so we were still north of $3 on the front end of the strip at that point. So you kind of factor that in. We didn't feel like we were selling low, to answer your first question. We felt like that was a healthy strip to sell into, north of $3 on the front end, 375 to $4 on the back end. We felt really good about that. You know, because we had sold, you know, those other transactions, the Saxum and Whitehawk plus cash flow, you know, we had the ability to, you know, sell this to these guys for what we believe to be a really good number and still and hit a 2x return. You know, we did debate and we did have discussions with NGP. Do we wait? You know, why sell now? This has unbelievable yield and cash flow. Why not, you know, why not hold this another 2 years and sell? I think to us and really to me, it was, you know, a bird in the hand at, you know, north of a 2x net return. You hit it. And then we knew we had the ability to go back out and build again. We had already started. We already, at that point, we, you know, we'd already started building back in the Haynesville. We were starting to build our Permian portfolio. So to us, it was kind of like, you know, it's hard to turn that down. It was a good number. It was a strong valuation. We weren't in a low price environment because the prices dropped kind of following that in December, January. And I know it kind of looked like that because our press release came out in January when prices had already dropped. But, you know, we inked that deal in November. And really, think about it, they evaluated it more like in summer months. So pricing was much different. So what really wasn't a sell low type deal, it was probably a sell high or sell medium if you had to gauge it.
Yeah, the other point you bring up, and I'm not familiar with Franco-Nevada's hedging strategy, if they do hedge at all, but just when you're selling gas, a large gas portfolio right now, usually the counterparty is going to be locking in some hedges to protect some downside. And it's a great environment to do that. So it's not necessarily what the spot is today, especially if there's an inventory heavy portfolio. So like you said, it can be a little misleading on, you know, when the press release comes out and just what the current state is of Henry Hub today. But I appreciate you answering that. I mean, the other thing too is doing another deal with Franco-Nevada. The last time they did a deal was with Mesa One in December 2020. You could argue, you know, commodity price-wise, kind of a murky time as well. But they hadn't done anything since. And this was a bilateral deal. You did it direct. My understanding is, you know, Franco-Nevada is a diversified royalties company. And what they call diversified assets is what their oil and gas royalties portfolio sits at. There is a threshold limitation. They don't want to have over 20% of their revenue in oil and gas. So I believe with the run-up in pricing, maybe some additional growth in the other parts of the portfolio, you know, they were kind of sitting out because their portfolio of oil and gas royalties was performing so well. And then they must have dipped back down below the 20%. Again, whether it was prices going down a little bit on their revenue or a combination of growing the gold part and the other sectors. But they came to the table, they got another deal done with you guys. Have you kept a dialogue kind of ongoing for years? Did you circle back, you know, early this year? When did you said you started talking in the summer, but they were very, very quiet, right? For someone from my perspective who speaks with a lot of people very regularly, you know, Franco-Nevada has been very much on the sidelines. So curious how that transpired.
Yeah, so no, they have been on the sideline. We do keep a dialogue going with them. So the relationship with us and Jason and Paul and the team over there, I mean, it dates all the way back to 2014. And, you know, at one point, you know, we were looking at potentially selling Haymaker to those guys and then becoming their U.S. team. So we spent a lot of time in Canada with those guys and really got to know them, you know, on that front. And that was almost 10 years ago. And then, you know, really, you know, we sold Mesa One to them. We've continued to dialogue. Obviously, you know, when we think about a relationship with a group like that, it's not a one-time sale and we're going to fleece you and see you later. It's the type of relationship we want to build and have repeat business. And so we continue to have dialogues with them, whether it's about assets they bought for us, helping them get those in pay or just about the market in general. And so, you know, we have continued dialogues and discussions with those guys. And, you know, this is the type of deal where, you know, just reached out on a normal discussion with them back in the summer of last year and kind of told them that, you know, we'd had these prior sales, had this remaining assets left, you know, where were they at, you know, as far as their percentage of oil and gas versus precious metals. And it kind of just happened to work out where they said, hey, let's take a look at it. And, you know, this asset sits directly adjacent. They bought our stuff in the East Texas side of the Haynesville, which was in Harrison and Panola County. This is right over the border and literally butted up right against this. So they liked that a lot. I think they really liked the performance of, you know, our East Texas Haynesville assets. They didn't, my understanding is that they did not hedge any of that. And so when they bought that gas ran, you know, they're sitting really pretty on their returns on that. I know we did really well on that. They've done really well on that asset. This asset's right next to it. Better rock, dual zone. You know, as you go east, obviously everything gets better in the Haynesville. So there was a lot of things that they liked about like what we had built and how this was, you know, a really good fit for them. And I think they've gotten really comfortable with working with us. I think we did a PSA with them in record time and probably a day or two, you know, given that, you know, we've worked with them, you know, before and, you know, have a really easy relationship. So we continue that dialogue with them. And you know, I think they've been really happy about what they bought with us. And we want to continue to have repeat business with those guys.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting is just the fact that you did this deal off market. You did the deal earlier on the acquisition front from Noble off market. That speaks to relationships. You know, I didn't know the backstory with Haymaker and Franco-Nevada. That's really interesting. But we're all, again, it's a very close-knit space. So we all see each other very regularly and, you know, develop relationships. But is it a sense of you do deals with folks, you get to know them and you're comfortable and it's just more relationship based? Or like in the Haynesville, you have a very good understanding of pricing and what you guys pay and what you've exited before. You kind of know what Franco-Nevada is looking for. They have an idea of what your prerogatives are on the fund side. And so it's really just a meeting of the minds and less quote unquote pricing discovery that you would frankly hire a bank to run a process to get pricing discovery in the market. And maybe you didn't feel a need for that, just given how stuck in you've been in the Haynesville. I mean, the bilateral nature of it, I think everyone covets the off-market deals, but in reality, a lot of the bigger ones do end up getting marketed. And so it seems to be a bit of a trend of late. You've gotten some big ones snagged off-market. So unpack that a little bit. I'm curious.
So I think when we even think back to, you know, the first sale we did with Saxon at Mesa 2, you know, Jeffries was our advisor. Saxum really came through us through the NGP connection. They were, you know, formerly, you know, backed by NGP. They had the relationship there. So that was kind of a relationship that us and NGP had fostered on that front. You could kind of call that off market a bit. They did come through the official process. The White Hawk guys came through kind of after the process was over. That was from a relationship that Daniel and I had had that kind of came through. So that was really off market. And then obviously the Franco-Nevada transaction was through that relationship, but clearly off market. And then the recent acquisition that we did was one that they had not gone out with a bank. That was something we had identified really for, you know, the last year that, you know, we'd wanted to talk to them about. And it just kind of became the right time in their fund life and the right time for us with the new commitment from NGP.
No, for sure. And just for those listening, just we'll run through the stats on the Mesa 2 asset that was sold to Franco-Nevada. So again, 125 million US, roughly 11,255 NRAs, heavy on the Louisiana side. Quick math, roughly 11,100 NRA production, 6,500 million cubic feet a day of net royalty production in 2023, and primary operating exposure, Southwestern, Chesapeake, and Comstock. Anything else you want to add to that, Darren, before we, you know, move on?
The value in net well counts, I'd say we're roughly 50% PDP WIP and permit and 50% call it inventory and pre-app. So really like a 50-50 inventory PDP deal. It was a really good yield. I mean, even in the price drop where we're at today, using today's strip pricing, their 2024 yield, probably over 12% on what they bought from us. 2025 yield, well north of 20%, and that's at strip. So, you know, definitely a win-win deal. And then the other thing I'd say about the price for NRA that's a little bit misleading is, you know, almost all of our acreage was dual zone. And so I think, you know, not all Haynesville acreage is created equal. And so there's a lot of portfolios you'll see that'll go to market that are the northern part of the play that's Haynesville only, single zone. You know, that may trade for $6,000 or $7,000 an acre, whereas something with dual zone may trade, you know, more like this. So, you know, you hear a lot of folks that have sold other portfolios in the Haynesville, and it's like, wow, that sounds like a big number. Well, it just depends how much of it is dual zone or not. So ours is practically all dual zone. But again, good outcome for us. I think a really good outcome for those guys. They did really well with the assets they had bought from us in Mesa One. So I think it was a win-win. And, you know, though we didn't have a bank that ran a process for us, they did have a buy-side advisor investment bank on their side that did work that.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com.
Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has been a leading ground game broker for minerals and non-op deals, closing over 120 transactions across the Permian, SCOOP/STACK, Haynesville, Bakken, Powder River Basin, DJ, and Eagleford. With deal sizes ranging from 50K upwards of 5 million and 1.5 NRAs upwards of 3,500 NRAs, the Texas Mineral Company can be flexible on where and how they can source your deal flow. For more information on how your team can work with the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com.
Scaling up your portfolio while minimizing G&A is the name of the game in the minerals and non-op space. Whether you're a brand new fund, an established team who's growing quickly, or a fully developed portfolio in harvest mode, Opportune's back office outsourcing team can help. Stop worrying about all the headaches that come along with day-to-day accounting and back office operations and contact Opportune today. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com.
Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Hi there, it's Rachel Reese at Our Recent Associates, your outhouse counsel. You may ask, what's an outhouse counsel? Well, it's a law firm that is focused on the day-to-day legal tasks that normally would be completed by your legal department. Our attorneys in Houston and DFW have spent their careers in both in-house positions and at large law firms and can provide your company with the efficient and responsive service you would expect from your own legal department for things like contracts, transactions, and title opinions at a fraction of the cost of what you're used to paying. So whether your company has no legal department or your legal department is a mighty team of one, we can help. Give us a call at 832-831-2289 or learn more at rreeselaw.com.
All righty. Well, let's bring it all back then. I appreciate you walking through the transactions. Just let's talk macro, natural gas pricing. We've already been referencing, the healthy, strip going forward and the benefits of that. The LNG space, any kind of pertinent updates there on delays or anything else overseas that might affect, the LNG value chain. I think the main headline, which we can start with, is the LNG pause with Biden. So in late January of this year, 2024, Biden's administration announced a temporary pause on pending and future applications to export LNG to non-FTA countries until the Department of Energy could update their underlying analysis for authorizations. This is actually, in preparing for this episode, the first time I actually read anything on this. It's all been chatter, right, at receptions and, one-off comments you see on LinkedIn. The way that's languaged seems like a complete punt, and it's a joke. Like, to update underlying analysis, to me, that just looks like something that has very big political drive behind it, and they're already starting to unravel it. And I just feel like it's something that's appears to me like noise in the market, and then come post elections will go away just because of how important exporting LNG will be for the health of the economy. But you're closer to this because all these things, I'm sure, are reviewed with a fine tooth and comb by NGP and yourselves. But how do you guys view the quote unquote LNG pause? Over to you.
I think it's definitely a stunt, first of all, a political stunt, but it is real from the standpoint that it is having effect right now, in our opinion, on longer term LNG projects. And those are projects that are like 3 to 5 years out. And it does have an effect on those guys raising money. It does have an effect on those guys slowing up their timeline. We have studied this, ad nauseum with both us and NGP and outside folks, obviously trying to learn more about it. But the real high level thing to think about in the way we understand it is there are 10 BCF a day of LNG exports that cannot be touched by this pause. So those are projects that are further along with the DOE that cannot be impacted by this pause. So a good way the way we look at it is like that's 10 BCF plus the existing 14 BCF a day of export LNG that's going out now. So that's over 24 BCF of LNG export that really can't be affected by this political stunt and this pause. Whether the longer term projects remain to be affected, I think is all going to be dependent on the election in November. And I think Trump gets in, probably it goes away. Biden gets in, probably 50-50, it goes away. I don't know that this is something they're going to dig their heels on long term. But I do think that, for us in thinking about, a big investment that we're making in natural gas, this is LNG is the, if not the biggest driver, the most important thing to think about for the future, what pricing will look like. It's, if you take 24 BCF a day going out, you've got declining, natural gas in almost every play over the next 2 to 3 years. You've got the continued industrial demand, continued Mexico demand. Mexico right now, 6 BCF a day that we have going over to Mexico right now today. That's continuing to grow. Industrial demand in the U.S. continues to grow. And not even to mention Mexico's import or export LNG projects that they've got, that they have in the works. It's not even factored into that 10 BCF additional export going out. So, all of those things make us bullish. I was reading a really good article on the, the effect that AI and, we already seen what Bitcoin is going to have. There's going to have to be a lot of energy that goes into, the AI centers, and natural gas is where that's going to come from. So that's going to be a big driver. All of this makes us very bullish on natural gas and what that looks like in the next 3 to 5 years. Is natural gas going to be volatile in the next 12 to 18 months? Absolutely. It's not going to be for the faint of heart to invest in. But over the next 3 to 5 years, we're very bullish on where this is going.
Yeah, just to piggyback on your comments around AI and data centers, I think we probably read similar articles, but saw something like, there'll be a 80% increase in electricity demand driven by data centers. I mean, I don't think people can appreciate how energy intensive some of these computers are. And it's the cooling, I think, what drives a lot of the electricity use. So that's, you know, something that doesn't get talked about a lot, just with where technology is going. That's not slowing down anytime soon. That's infinite growth, right? Especially as you start to look at, you know, virtual reality and all these other things that are going to become prevalent in society. So I don't know. Like you said, it's hard to get to an exact factual number, but it all adds up. It's going in one direction. And you feel like owning gas for the medium term is definitely a good place to be. Have you seen any of these things, the pause and possible effects on projects, like affect or be baked into the strip at all in futures pricing? I mean, how do you guys, when you're looking at underwriting deals and how the strip kind of fluctuates, you know, just for everyone listening, as of today, April 9th, I believe gas is hovering around $1.80 an MCF, the 12-month strip, $2.78, the 24-month strip, $3.20, 36-month strip, $3.42, 48-month strip, $3.52, and the 60-month strip, $3.58. So I don't follow it on a day-to-day basis. I know when you're doing transactions, you probably wake up every day and have the RBC desktop there and you're tracking everything. Does this stuff fluctuate a lot, or is it fairly stable? Over to you.
You know, if you think of the back end of the strip, you know, which we believe, you know, the back end of the strip and, you know, 48, 60 months does have some component of LNG baked into it. You know, if you look back, you know, 12 months, 18 months ago, that was closer to 425. It's kind of shrinked back now to more like 360 on the back end. I think there's some room to push up on that as these LNG projects come on and become real. You also have to remember we've had two warm winters in a row, which is kind of unheard of. And so, you know, like this winter, for example, we follow it a lot. We talk to a lot of traders. We, you know, talk to a lot of different groups that help us on, you know, on pricing and better understanding that, like, after that big cold front we had, it wiped out storage. If we would have had another cold front come in anytime in February or March, it would be a much different scenario than what we're looking at today. That didn't transform, and we're at where we're at today. But two winters in a row of warm weather, I think that's the big impact that you're seeing on the front end more than anything. And you see it every day when, you know, you look at the next 15 days and the heating days that are lost or gained. And that's really where everything's driven right now on the front end of the strip. We do follow it quite a bit. I think the LNG is factored in on the back end. I think that there's definitely room to grow, and there's a bunch of upside to where that's at today, though.
Yeah, I mean, this is all speculative on my part, but you could say possibly some of the risk, you know, political risk with the LNG pause and the uncertainty that some of that might cause could be a reason that there's a bit of softening on the 48 to 60 month strip, right? Going from over $4, like you said last year, to, you know, just over $3.50. So good food for thought. It's interesting nonetheless. No one has a crystal ball, right? So it does fluctuate, but there's a lot of factors to play. You know, I had Will Harris onto my podcast probably a month or two ago at DV Trading, and he talked about droughts in the Panama Canal leading to, you know, challenges with getting exports over to Asia. And so there's less LNG being exported to Asia because less ships can go through the Panama Canal because they're low on water. And it basically, you know, the water fills up, the ship goes over the mountain, and then it goes down. And that's all fed from, you know, their natural water system. So like stuff like that, I had never heard that before, but that's interesting, right? And so does that drought continue, or does that get replenished and balance out some of the you know, supply demand dynamics and the export or in the spot market? Who knows? But anyways, bring it all kind of full circle. I appreciate walking through everything and really lifting the hood, Darren. I think it's one of the things that's led to your success, right? I mean, you've done all these bilateral deals, you have good relationships, you're on the pulse of the market. Your team has done a fantastic job timing everything. What's the closing message summarizing it? So Mesa 3, y'all are back in business. You got 12,000 NRAs, you know, and that's just in the Haynesville, right? So what's the best way to collaborate with you guys? What do you guys want to be seeing? What kind of size deals? Just, you know, we got Mark coming up. So if someone bumps into a Mark, what do you want to be talking about? What's the ideal opportunity and ways to get some stuff done with Mesa 3?
So yeah, you hit on it. You know, our Haynesville acreage now around 12,000 acres. You know, Permian wise around 4,000. So think of us pro forma around 16,000 net royalty acres across those two basins. You know, I think interestingly, we've deployed over $165 million in the last 12 months. And that's something that, you know, is very rare to have a burn rate like that. But $165 million in the last 12 months. We recently upsized our equity commitment with NGP from $150 to $250 million. So continuing to be active in both the Permian and the Haynesville. I'd say, you know, for groups in the Permian, keep us in mind. You know, we're very active. You know, we've got a large ground game group, but please send us deals, send them direct to me if you'd like. We're actively buying in the Permian, preferably in the Delaware, but we're also looking at stuff in the Midland. Continue to buy in the Haynesville. We've got our, you know, obviously CMOS deal flow that comes through there. But, you know, if there's a portfolio or someone who's putting stuff together, please keep us in mind for that as well. But ultimately, you know, we want to keep growing both these basins. And, you know, we're in buyer mode now. We're not in seller mode. Just exited Mesa 2 and really continuing to aggregate and grow these positions to look to take these to market, you know, in the years to come.
Yeah. And I'd say if there's others at a smaller scale that are in buy mode and not sell mode, I mean, keep the dialogue open, right? Because do you want to be in sell mode in 18 months? It's what you've done very well when you're talking to the Francos of the world, right? Hey, this is where we're at today. This is the plan for the next 12 to 24 months. We'll keep educating you on what our asset looks like. And I think that's ultimately why you've been able to time things so well, because you're not starting from scratch. So that goes both ways at all sizes and shapes. I think it's why we all spend so much time, you know, mingling and doing dinners and drink receptions and all that, is to just stay on top of where everyone's at. There's a lot of deal flow to be had, and hopefully there's more to come between you and your peers, right, Darren? So I appreciate you coming on as always. It's a great discussion. Again, congrats to you and Greg and Josh and the rest of the team, and looking forward to seeing you here in a few weeks.
Sounds good, Tim. Thank you.
Take care.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.